about this is a one-time event with the possibility of doing it again. A big thank you to the Mendel family who has been pursuing this for months. This has been in the works literally since the summer.
Because you've also been encouraging it for months. It's just a matter of coming to fruition.
It's a good idea. I'm saying that what we discovered is there are a lot of questions that people have that they don't get to call in. So it's good to know that I do have WhatsApp and people can send voice messages with questions. Sometimes the answer is we have to talk. I got a phone call about 3 years ago, someone very vatik, someone who's been in the community for a long time, and they asked me to do the following. Could you call every house and ask them if they have questions? So I said, no. So he said, I think a lot of the women of the killer have questions and they're not calling. So I said, okay, I hear the problem. I don't think that's the solution, though. So that's what he wanted me to do. I think that hopefully, A, this gives a venue for people to anonymously ask questions. B, people can ask questions through my wife. And I hope that people will be comfortable to ask their questions. And again, there's always the possibility if someone's uncomfortable to ask anonymously, which is 100% legitimate. It's a beautiful thing that the Mendel family pursued this and then took it upon themselves to host this. And b'emet toda rabba, yishar koach to both of you. Discussing halacha with wives is a challenging thing because on many levels, it's the husband's job to check out the halacha. And we don't want a situation where the wife comes home and says, I know you said A, but I learned B. So there's a certain element where we have to figure out how to how to blend what we learn, discuss it. Maybe your husband goes by what he learned in yeshiva, and that's fine. I'm saying our goal here is not to cause any rifts, but to bring clarity. And we know that in halacha, there isn't only one shita. Even if you're Ashkenazi, there are multiple opinions. There are homes that are participants in our community, and their homes go by the halacha that we learn. And then it makes sense to come home and say, okay, we learned A or B or C. And still, your husband might have very valid points why this isn't the way your house goes. And in no way should the person come home and say, I learned A, so you're obviously wrong. No, we're going to learn, and we can't cover, you know, every shita and every topic, but we will learn what I think is the basic general approach to these questions that I have understood in halacha, that I've learned from my teachers, that I think is the basic halacha in Israel. There are things that the halacha in America, the accepted opinions are different than in Israel, and we're going to try to work with what's accepted here. We're living here, so our homes have to run with what the halachic norm is in Israel. So we'll go in order. The first question I don't want to address, but I'm not sure I have a choice. And the reason is, again, because in America, I think there are opinions that are more lenient. I could not find them when I went searching for them practically in the last week since the question came in. But in Israel, the accepted opinion is what we'll discuss in a second. So the question was, what needs to go into Seamus? English quotes from a Chumash, English translations to the Chumash, a publication of Torah Tidbits that has quotes from Chumash, etc. So the truth is that in Israel, the accepted opinion in most circles, I know Rav Melamed in Basheva said you could toss the Basheva, but that's not the accepted opinion. I'm saying most Rabbanim you'll talk to, and most in Israel, the accepted opinion is the basic opinion that anything that has words of Torah, and words of Torah doesn't have to be a quote from the Chumash or Tanakh. If it's Torah, meaning if we're learning a Dvar Torah from a paper, then the accepted opinion, and I went searching, because in the United States, that's not what I learned. In the United States, I learned more lenient opinions. Here in Israel, I couldn't find anyone from the accepted mainstream opinions that's willing to be more lenient. And even this week, I went to another Beit Torah. I wanted to hear, is there a more lenient opinion that's accepted in Israel? I didn't find it. Again, I know Rav Melamed wrote differently, but Rav Melamed on many things goes on his own. So that makes life a little bit more challenging. I'm not going with the most stringent opinion of Rav Nevenzal, who actually cuts out every time it says on a wrapper, Edah Haredit Yerushalayim. He doesn't want to put the word Yerushalayim in the garbage. Or Birchato Sheakol, where he says that's a halachic psak, so you can't put that in the garbage. I'm not discussing that. I'm saying there are opinions here which I'm not bringing to the discussion. But when we learn Torah from something, so we view it as something that's Torah, and that can include a Torah tidbit. So that's why I tell my kids, don't bring it home. You want to read it in wherever you find it, read it. You bring it home, and then you end up having a pile of Seamus, Geniza, what are you going to do with it? So that's the opinion that I have found here in Israel to be the accepted opinion, that anything that's Torah, if there's a quote, if it's a translation, if it's in a different language, bottom line, it's Torah, we're learning from it, and it should be treated with that respect, which means it should go to a place where it will be buried, and not, that's what Geniza really is, they just bury it in the ground. So that was question number one. Good evening, Reuven. And I said when you weren't here, thank you very much for hosting us. I'm not sure if it's better to have one long thing, so on one recorder I'll divide it into separate recordings. The second question was, if someone's feeding a baby chicken soup, and by mistake they touch the soup with their tongue to see if it's hot, are they now fleishik? So that's a very good question, and I think we should understand fleishik and milchik in general, and then we'll approach this question. We know that after we eat any type of meat, it doesn't matter if it's meat or chicken, so we're fleishik for however long your custom is. If you're Dutch, it's 1 hour. If you're Yeki, it's 3 hours. And if you're everyone else, it's 6 hours. Now, the reasoning behind this halacha, we have two reasons quoted in halacha. One is that Chazal were concerned that people get food, meat gets caught between the teeth. And for 6 hours after you ate, so that meat is considered food, and you don't want that mixing with the milk after you've eaten. And the other is that meat has fats, has oils, and it takes time to digest. And for 6 hours after you've eaten, our assumption is that you're still with some meat in your mouth, if you call it that. That the digestion of the meat takes 6 hours. Our custom is that, let's say you wait 6 hours. It doesn't matter if you ate the meat itself or you ate chicken soup. The fact of the matter is, you ate something from our end. It doesn't matter if you just ate the soup. You didn't eat the meat, but the soup had meat cooked inside. So then we wait the same 6 hours. This is not the case if you cooked food in an oven where there was no meat in the food. It's a meat oven. Even if your oven was dirty, it's still not meat. You cooked bread. Okay, you shouldn't really cook bread and make it meat. But you cooked whatever you cooked, parve, in a meat oven, you don't have to wait. We're going to discuss later, can you actually eat it with sour cream? If you cooked something in a meat pot, but there was no meat there, you don't have to wait. So then the question becomes, okay, so how much do I have to eat in order to have to wait 6 hours? We said, if I ate the soup but not the chicken, even if there's no more chicken left there, but the chicken was cooked in the soup, I have to wait whatever amount of time I usually wait. So here, the assumption is that until you did an act of swallowing, until you did that, you didn't eat. And then you don't have to wait the 6 hours. If you just put it on your tongue, or you just touched it with your tongue, even though you tasted the flavor, that's not called eating. And until you actually swallow, you don't have to wait the 6 hours. It's interesting that in ancient time they didn't have baby food. They would take chicken, chew it, and then give it to the baby. So there we understand, you can't say, I didn't swallow, I don't have to wait, because we said there are two reasons. One is the food getting stuck in the teeth. You chewed the chicken, we still have to be concerned that food could have gotten caught in the teeth. Once we touch on this, I want to mention the breakdown of the halacha of waiting 6 hours. The halacha of waiting 6 hours, as explained by the Kaf HaChaim, Sfaradi Posek, is broken down into multiple components. Midoraita, biblically, I can't eat meat with milk, right? I can't cook meat with milk. And then the first hour that we wait is rabbinic. On eating meat with milk being doraita, I'm really glossing over that topic. It really deserves more attention. Those who are curious, online we just started a series at Machon Meir on the laws of the dietary laws, meat and milk. And it's a 10 minutes every three times a week. And we're really working from the ground up. You can follow that. I have a website with free, the shiurim are for free, 123torah.com. And you could really learn the details. But for what we need, in general, the first hour is a din derabanan. After the first hour, it's a minhag. So we know that minhag is very important, and we know that the person who gives over minhag is the mother. Al titosh torat imecha. I like to say that the father can start telling the child all kinds of reasons why he should do something or not, and the mother just says, "We're Jewish, that's what we do." And that's al titosh torat imecha. We don't let go of what our mother teaches us. And Chazal say that many times what the mother teaches stays with the kid much more than what the father teaches. Even though the father might logically explain how the Gemara, the Pasuk, the Halacha, and everything, bottom line, the main chinuch and the baseline, the neshama, the appreciation for Torah, really comes from the mother. So in no way should we look at a minig and say it's just a minig. It's a minig, which is very important. Nonetheless, halachically, the way we treat a minig is not on the same severity as a din d'rabbanan. And that means that if a person has a medical reason, let's say a woman's pregnant and she's having heartburn, and it's very difficult for her to wait. The milk calms down her heartburn. Or there can be other reasons why the milk would help the milk she's giving the baby. Or there can be other reasons which are not life-threatening, but there are serious inconvenience waiting the 6 hours for eating the milk product. So you should ask the Shaila, because very often the answer is going to be, wait 1 hour and don't wait more than that. It's not uncommon that a nursing mother or a pregnant mother or someone who's dealing with heartburn or whatever, there was an oncology patient a month ago that they were fighting to get his diet balanced, and he wouldn't eat any milk product because he just ate meat. He said, we have to wait 6 hours. So that's not true, right? We can understand that when a person's health requires it. So the first thing that's going to go is the 6 hours. We're going to go down to 1 hour, and if necessary, we'll go down to less. So it's always worth asking a shayla. I always say you don't lose by asking. You're machmir without asking. If you ask, you're not worse off than you were without asking. So that's the second question. So if we're feeding a baby chicken soup and you touch it with your tongue to see how hot it is, you're not phlegic. You do have to wash out your mouth, meaning your mouth has the oils, whatever. You just ate chicken or chicken soup, so you'll drink a cup of water. You have to clean out your mouth. You can't just take a cup of milk after that. But aside from that, you're not fleshik, so long as you didn't swallow.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yeah.
Right. So that is this a lechachil or b'diyavid? Meaning, let's say I'm cooking for Shabbos, and I don't want to be fleshik, but I want to see if the seasoning's right in food. Am I allowed to knowingly sort of just put a little bit in my mouth and then not consider myself fleshik? I'm just thinking based on this, it leads to another question.
Right. If it's necessary, meaning... Okay, that brings us...
That's more that it almost sounded like I didn't intend to, but...
Right, so, yeah.
The question is, what if...
Again, okay, so I want to address that in a broader sense. So the question was asked, can I do this lechatchila, to just taste the chicken soup with my tongue? Before addressing that question, I want to address a different question, which will be relevant to a lot of the questions that people ask. There's something that happens in many homes where the husband actually learned the halachot of kashrut, and that is that the husband does things that the wife doesn't approve of. And the wife says that's not kosher, and the husband starts explaining why it's not a big deal. Someone from the previous generation once said, you can find your husband eating meat and milk and telling you it's okay, they're all cold. Obviously, it's not okay. But the things that are customary in a home, even if halachically we're going to say, you know, you don't have to do A, you don't have to do B, C is really okay, nothing terrible happened. There's a way to run a home and a way to run a kitchen, and there's a good reason why we don't do. Like, your husband's going to take the fleishik sponge to clean the milchik dishes, and when he's done, you're going to say, you just tarfed my dishes. And he's going to say they're clean, and everything was cold, and there was soap, and he's going to give you a million reasons why it's okay. And then you're going to say, but don't do it next time. And he'll say, I'll try. And you'll say, no, not I'll try. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, who's right? You're right. Meaning the truth is, there's a reason why we have a fleishik sponge and a milchik sponge. There's a reason why we have fleishik dish towels and milchik dish towels. So one might argue, wait, I'm only using the dish towels when the dishes are clean, if I'm using them to dry the dishes. So why do I need meat and milk? I'm only drying water off. Okay, so at that moment, you're not thinking about it. But then one day you'll notice that sometimes when you're taking things out of the oven, you do use those towels. And if you're going to use them for meat and milk, you're going to end up having the grease from the meat on your towels and then into the milk oven. And there are many different things that we do that on the moment we don't always know, why do I have to do that? But that's what my mother did, or that's what I know they taught me in seminary. This is the way I know I should run a kosher kitchen. And that's a good answer. Meaning, one of the things many years ago, about 20 years ago, I was researching a minhag that many women have, that if they mix a knife, they put it in a sand. They put it in the ground. Even if they're going to kosher it, they first put it in the ground. So what's interesting is that this minhag appears in Yemen. This minhag appears in Germany. This minhag appears all over the world. So the Gemara in the Masechet Avodah Zarah describes that here's another one that your husbands might have done to you. Take a fleishik knife, cut an apple, and sit and eat it with a slice of cheese. And you say, you just cut it with a fleishik knife. And he answers, it's not a davar harif, it's not sharp, it doesn't really take out flavor. Well, the truth is, in Shulchan Aruch it says that if you cut with a fleishik knife, we assume that our knives have oil on them. We assume that even after we clean them, there's a little bit of residue left. So the Gemara says, if you really want to clean it, stick it in the ground 10 times, and then you'll clean it by sticking it into the ground, sticking it into the coarse ground, and then you could talk about of the knife being clean. So then the question becomes, what is our steel wool like? And how do we view our soap and our scotch, right? Is that equal sticking it into the ground? Well, let's take a step back. The baseline of don't cut an apple with a fleishik knife when you're going to eat it at a milchik meal is right. Right? So I was researching this minhag. The Gemara discusses cleaning off a knife from fats by sticking it in the ground 10 times. This custom has nothing to do with that. My grandmother used to have flower pots with knives in them. And literally, that's what they did in Germany. They would put the knives in the pots. So one of the rabbanim I asked was the Bosner Rebbe. I had the good fortune to spend Shabbos by the Bosner Rebbe, and he was at the room, and his son, the Dayan, Rav Pinchas Horowitz, was also in the room, and they have these big meals, like a lot of tables, and I asked, can I ask the Rav in Boston, in your Hasidus, do you guys also put knives in the flower pots? Now, the way the table was set up, the Rebbe sat at one table, we the guests at another table, his daughters, granddaughters at a far table, and like a mamash, a real division. So the Rebbe laughed and said, nah, no such thing. So I suddenly hear a commotion by the women's table. So I asked the Rebbe, could we find out what they were saying? And it turns out that his own daughter-in-law and granddaughters, and they were all doing it. So he says to me, okay. So the minhag reached Boston too. So I'm coming back to the idea of there's a way we run a kitchen, and the things you learned very often are our baseline is they're valid. What you learn, what you see other people doing, there's a reason we do it. And so coming back to here, tasting the chicken soup. Technically, halachically, mutar. You're allowed to do it. Practically, ask yourself, will you remember to wash out your mouth? If you're in the middle of feeding the baby cottage cheese, are you not going to take a bite of that cottage cheese when you just tasted the chicken soup without remembering? This is where we run into things that the halacha doesn't always define. Where it's a question of, do you really want to run your house that way? But is it mutar lechatchila? Yeah. Yeah, the Gemara discusses matemet. The Gemara discusses the idea of chewing licorice sticks. that you don't make a bracha on a piece of wood, even though the flavor you're tasting. And we even have a discussion on a fast day if we're allowed to chew those sticks. So at the end of the day, when you just touched the soup and you really didn't swallow anything, you can't say you did something wrong. The question becomes, do you want to run your house that way? Is it mutter? Yeah, it's mutter. It's not necessarily a good habit. And will you always pay attention not to take that, like a whole spoonful and swallow? Again, technically, it's mutter. It's a question of thinking how you want to run your house. Okay. The next question was asked, are we allowed to use a sand timer on Shabbos? So the question is, why do you want to use a sand timer on Shabbos? And we'll explain. Why wouldn't we be allowed to use a sand timer on Shabbos? So the Gemara brings us the Pasuk in Ezra. We know that in the beginning of the second temple period, the second Beit HaMikdash, Ezra comes back to Eretz Yisrael and he finds people, they're pressing wine on Shabbos, they're doing business on Shabbos. The situation here is dismal. And then Ezra comes and says, you guys have to stop this. They were married to non-Jewish women. And the women and the people say, where in Torah does it say no doing business on Shabbos? So Ezra sees he's not going to get very far. He has as his right-hand man, Nehemiah, who's a leading politician who has the political clout. He's basically the governor of Israel for the time. And so Ezra says, okay, no using any instruments on Shabbos. And he invents the Isser of Muktzeh. And at that point, people have to eat with their hands. For the next few years, there's no using any dishes on Shabbos. Ezra goes to the extreme. He says, you guys are going to argue with me. We're going to ensure every shop is closed. We're going to have policemen walking around pulling people's hairs out if they try to, that's the Pasuk says. In the Mavet, they gave the death penalty. Ezra has to bring the Jewish people back to keeping Shabbos, meaning the Shabbos was not observed in the land of Israel by the masses in the beginning of the period of the second Beit HaMikdash. So Ezra makes an institution of Muktzeh, which is not the first institution. In the days of David HaMelech, already there were some laws of Muktzeh. And Ezra's institution goes very far. And then Ezra, as time goes on, so they become more lax and more lax, until finally we reach the Muktzeh that we know today, that we don't use instruments that are either, you don't use something, we don't handle something that has no use on Shabbos, like a stone, like a twig, like sand, unless... if you spray painted that stone as a paperweight, okay, so that's not muktzah. Money has no use on Shabbos. Money isn't really an instrument. So all of that is muktzah on Shabbos. We know the classical muktzah, our pens, our tape recorders, anything that's used for a prohibited action, that's called kli, shemlachtoli sur, an instrument that's used for prohibited action on Shabbos. So we're not allowed to handle that on Shabbos. So we don't touch our cell phones on Shabbos. It's a good idea to think if you want them on, because kids have a big temptation today to look at their SMSs on Shabbos. It's the new temptation. Kids from Shomer Shabbos homes consider themselves Shomer Shabbos, and they're SMSing and WhatsApping on Shabbos. So it's a good idea to get into the habit that we turn off all cell phones before Shabbos. If for security purposes you want one on, so leave the parents one on. But I'm saying it's something to think about. We have to recognize the generation we're in and the challenges our children are facing. So we have instruments that are prohibited. So one of the things that Ezra instituted was, you're not allowed to measure on Shabbos. Ezra didn't want people doing business. So Ezra said, people cannot measure. So measuring was part of business. You had to weigh what you were selling. You had to weigh the money. So measuring became one of the prohibitions of Shabbos. We don't measure. So people sometimes ask, am I allowed to take a kid's temperature on Shabbos? And the answer is yes. Wait, but I'm measuring. Right. No. Wait, yes or no? The answer is, if you're taking his temperature for nothing, then you're right, that's measuring, you're right, you can't take his temperature. But you're never taking his temperature for nothing. The reason you're taking his temperature is because you think he might have a fever. And that's why if you ever think to ask the question, don't bother asking the question. You could take his temperature on Shabbos. If there's room to ask the question, then the answer is yes, you may. You don't have to ask the question. The whole idea of not measuring was a zerah, a rabbinic prohibition, to ensure we won't come to do business on Shabbos. So if there's any room to think a baby is ill, we take the temperature. Now, ideally, you should have an analog thermometer, not a digital thermometer. We had a gemach in shul, I don't know if it still exists, of plain thermometers, you know, that people could use. It's a good idea to have them because the digital ones also are very often inaccurate. We bought maybe 7 or 8 different digital thermometers, always thinking the next company is going to be better. And we found over and over again that the kids had fever and it didn't record it. Sometimes they didn't have fever and it did record it. We found them to be very unreliable. We thought American thermometers would be better. And we had the same experience. Switch batteries. We did a lot because it's uncomfortable for a child, especially when a child is a year old or whatever. You're doing it in a way that's very uncomfortable for a child. But we found them to be unreliable. So ideally, if you can, that's much better to use not a digital. Once you're dealing with a digital, and you're not only asking the question of measuring, you're asking the question of turning on something electric, etc. That's a different question. But our assumption, just for the record, is that for children, any fever above 38.5 is something to be concerned about to the point of pikuach nefesh. For babies up to 6 months old, anything above 38 concerns us, and at 38.5 you have to go to the hospital. You can do the math to figure out what that is in Fahrenheit, I don't know. So we don't weigh things, we don't measure things on Shabbos. That means even if you want to know how tall your kid is, you're not going to measure him on Shabbos. We're not going to weigh spices on Shabbos, even on Yom Tov. Well, Yom Tov deserves its own discussion. But for the sake of a mitzvah, it's mutter. So Chazal permitted us to weigh and measure for the sake of a mitzvah. So on Yom Kippur, when you have someone who's allowed to eat less than a shiur, they're at a state where if they eat a smaller amount, they will not be in danger, they'll be perfectly fine. So then we tell them, okay, so eat a little bit every 9 minutes or every 4 minutes, depending on what their medical need is. This is something, obviously, that you don't do at home. You ask a shaila about, right? Almost every year on Yom Kippur morning, someone walks over and asks the shaila. The ideal is not to do it that way. The ideal is to ask the question a week in advance where we could check out the medical facts. But if you didn't get to it before Yom Kippur, then at least ask the question on Yom Kippur. So you're allowed to measure the food on Yom Kippur when you need to eat it. You're allowed to measure if... I was once invited and they gave me this tiny cup to make Kiddush on. I didn't think it had a revius. So you're allowed to measure. That's a mitzvah. I need to have a revius in order to make Kiddush. So that's for the sake of a mitzvah. For the sake of a mitzvah, we're allowed to measure on Shabbos. Babies and formula. So very often parents say, I don't want to measure the formula. Well, that depends on the age of the baby and the needs of the baby. Many babies are sensitive, and if you're going to give an estimate of how much formula and how much water, it can upset the baby's stomach. So measure. Some babies, it really doesn't matter, and some parents really don't care. There are parents who just scoop it out and dump it in, put in the water, and they don't look during the week. So on Shabbos, obviously, why would you measure on Shabbos? But those of you who think you don't do that, let's see what you do when you're up to a later stage in life. But as the baby grows, it becomes less important. But if you think it's necessary, so then you should measure the baby's formula and the water. So now we come to the question of a sand timer on Shabbos. So sand timer is very interesting because you don't really know how much time is in the timer. Even when they tell you how much time, it's not accurate. The flip side is you are trying to get a certain time. So I imagine the reason people are using this is because they're playing Scrabble. Is there any other reason someone would use a sand timer? What? Games, right. So here again, I went searching because I had in mind once I had read an opinion that said that being that we have no idea how much time is in the timer, that's okay. And I couldn't find that. I could only find the opinions. So if someone knows of an opinion that permits it, I'm curious because I had in mind that that's what I learned, again, 20 years ago in the United States. But when I went searching after I got this question, I could only find the opinions that say it's prohibited to the point where Shmuel Shabbos Kilchoser of Neubert writes, you can't even handle a sand timer on Shabbos because technically it's an instrument used for measurement. It's no different than a measuring spoon. And so he says you can't even handle it on Shabbos. So again, if you find, I couldn't find it. Maybe I have a mistake in my memory. But the logic behind it was that the sand timers are not accurate. They're measuring a certain amount of time. We don't know how much time. But But being that we do all want the same amount of time for our turn at Scrabble or whatever, so we are measuring something, even if I don't know how much it is. Remember, in Chazal's time, they didn't know seconds. They didn't have measurements of time like we do. Their whole measurement of time was a sundial. That's why Chazal's clock is always talking about percentages of a day. 3 hours into a day is not 3 hours, right? It's what we call shot zmaniot. So it is measuring time. And that's why there's definitely, I don't know of anyone that permits it at this point. I'll be happy to find if I'm correct with what I remember. In time, the only poskim I could find prohibit the sand timer because it is used for measuring on Shabbos. We treat it like a regular instrument for measurement, and it would only be allowed for a mitzvah. So some of you might know that before Yom Kippur, for those women or men that have to eat shiurim, I give a sand timer before Yom Kippur, because that way they don't have to sit there watching their clock. They just turn it over, they take their bite, they turn it over, and it measures 9 minutes for them. So that's permissible, because that's their mitzvah on Yom Kippur, to eat a shiur and wait 9 minutes and eat a shiur less than a shiur again. So that's why it's permissible. But a sand timer, in general, on Shabbos, Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa says it's aser, and searching through a number of poskim, I couldn't find anyone that says differently. Okay, yeah.
Problem to use like measuring spoons?
Yeah.
Dressing,
yeah.
That's a measure.
Correct. Yeah.
And what's so regular teaspoons?
Like, so you're not supposed to flatten it out to get an exact measurement. Yeah.
And then if you take a measuring spoon and don't flatten it out, aren't you in the same?
Yeah, if it's inaccurate. The problem there is that you're using an instrument that's used for measurement. So it's muktzah. Uh-huh. You're not, I'm saying you could argue that it's tzorech gufo, that I'm using it like a spoon. I'm not using it for measuring. But then you run into the Rabbanon that Chazal didn't want you to use an instrument that looks like you're measuring on Shabbos. You could argue it doesn't look like it. Everyone sees it's heaping. So there's room to say that if you're going to do it that way, that everyone can see it's not a liquid, it's sugar. They see it's heaping. They see I'm not measuring. Again, the question would become, the only time you could use a kli shem lachta le'iser, an instrument that's used for a prohibited thing, a prohibited action, is if you don't have the equivalent lying around. A person's going to, he has his fork on the table and he could scratch his head with his fork. He doesn't want to, so he's going to go get a pen and scratch his head with the pen. So he's going to say, wait, it's tzor guf, I'm using that to scratch my head. He can't say that. Use the back of a spoon. I'm saying you could do the same thing. The heter of kli shem lachta le'iser is when I don't have the equivalent right now. I don't have, I want to use scissors because if I'm going to try to cut open whatever it is, I'm not going to do a good job with a knife. So then, whatever's mutter for me to cut on Shabbos, right, we'll get to an example of that later on. So then I could use the scissor. If I'm going to try to open a coconut without a hammer, I might get into trouble. It'll scatter all over. With the hammer, I'll get a better job. So then I could take the hammer because I don't have an alternative. But to say I need the measuring spoon sounds a little far-fetched. So the measuring spoon is really muktzah on Shabbos. It's used for measuring. Same thing with the measuring cup. And another thing that most people don't know, same thing with the pot. A pot is muktzah. The only reason we can use a pot on Shabbos is because it has food in it. But if I have an empty pot and I just want to move it somewhere, that pot is muktzah. It's used for cooking. I can say when I need to transfer my soup into a smaller pot, now I need it. It's tzorech gufo, so I'm allowed to take it. But when I just have an empty pot sitting on the counter and I'd like it not to be sitting on the counter, I can't remove it. If I need the counter space, that's tzorech makomo, then I'm allowed to move it. But if it's just because I feel like moving it, empty pots are muktzah. This isn't, by the way, this is Shulchan Aruch. What I just said is not my Chiddush. It's a sif in Shulchan Aruch.
I want to move it to the sink just to look better for Shabbos.
We'll get there.
And if I want to move it...
Let's just say Aser. Sir. Okay, and we'll get to the reasoning later. What?
But put on a hot plate upside down so I can put my food on.
So that's Sorech Gufo. You want its own use. I don't recommend doing that unless your handles are of metal, because I don't know what's about you, but I've forgotten many a pot and a pan on the hot plate, and they absorb the heat, and the handles just melted off. If not the first Shabbos, the second Shabbos. So that's practical. Okay, the next question I am going to discuss, even though I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know. I don't know the reality. The question was asked, can I use a non-electric vacuum cleaner on Shabbos like Abyssal? So, okay, I'm not sure it's going to help me. I went online and I looked at pictures. I'll explain what I don't know.
If you want to see it. I don't, someone told me you can't, but I don't
know. No, so I'll explain where the question becomes. So,
yeah,
okay, you can bring it. We'll see. I'll explain what I don't know, and I'm not sure I'll know.
That's what I use in my prep.
It's like a broom.
Oh, is it like a broom? So if it's only like a broom, if you're only going to use it, if you're using it on a floor, there's no problem. If all you're using it for is collecting crumbs, there's no problem. The problem... Oh, so the question is, what does it collect from the carpet? Meaning, if it's collecting things that are absorbed in the carpet, then I run into a problem of kibbutz, where one of the prohibited actions on Shabbos is laundering. So if it's collecting the crumbs...
It's a vacuum, but it's not a vacuum.
No, I think it's more the surface stuff that it picks up, but it's still, you're pulling out the hair.
You're pulling out the hair from the carpet.
That's a good question. Can you sweep a carpet?
On the floor, yes.
Again, the question is, am I taking out things that are absorbed?
Yeah.
Or am I taking out things that are not absorbed, like crumbs that are... I don't know. And when I tried researching, I couldn't find out. So... I think this is the type of thing where in the U.S. they'll know. You'll get a good answer. I'm
but
saying...
if it's absorbed, it's problematic. It's on the surface. It's
correct. If you're doing it, if you're collecting crumbs, it's mutter. If you're taking things that are absorbed in the carpet and you're taking them out, it's aser. I would just mention there's something which people sometimes don't realize, and that is that kibbutz is prohibited even with just water. Meaning if someone spilled grape juice on their shirt and they're just going to toss it into the water on Shabbos, that's aser. Meaning kibbutz is, by definition, even if I just put it in water in order to clean it, that's also kibbutz. Okay, the next question is an interesting one also. How can I clean a sticky floor, counter, plastic tablecloth, etc. on Shabbos? Okay, so I just want to check our timing. Is that clock on time? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, technically... we all know that we can wash dishes on Shabbos, right? We finish a meal, we can wash off the dishes. So I'm allowed to wash certain things on Shabbos. What am I not allowed to wash on Shabbos? So Chazal didn't want me washing things that absorb. And part of it is the issur of kibbutz we just spoke about, and part of it is a rabbinic application of that, like cleaning leather. So you'll say the leather didn't really absorb. Okay, that's where you hit the border between absorbing and not absorbing. We have a few more issues with cleaning. One issue is that if you're going to use a rag, a shmata, smartut, so you might come to squeezing it out. And Chazal didn't want us doing that. So if I have a small... I was once at a Shabbos table where something spilled. Someone took a napkin, cleaned it up, squeezed it out into the garbage, cleaned it up again, squeezed it out again. So that you're not supposed to do that on Shabbos. We have an extension of dash of the task of... threshing is we don't do schita. I'm not supposed to squeeze a lemon into my tea. So I'm also not supposed to squeeze a garment of its liquids. So Chazal didn't want me cleaning big spills with a rag where I might come to squeeze out that rag. So if I have a big spill on the floor and I could sweep it into a drain, okay, that should be fine. But there are other problems. And we'll go one by one. In Chazal's time, the floors were made of earth. And one of the things people did on a steady basis is they'd flatten the earth. We run into that sukkah's time. If you're sitting outside in the yard and you have your table wobbling, so you try to figure out how to flatten out the table or where you're sitting, your chair, and that's asul. Meaning I'm not allowed on Shabbos to flatten the earth where I'm sitting. It's part of fixing my house. And it can even be an isur d'oraita, the Gemara says. So Chazal initially forbade washing floors because people used to wash their dirt floors, which involved an isur, flattening the floor. Then the Gemara says one rabbi went to a certain attic and he permitted them to clean over there. So they asked him, how'd you do that? So he said, they had tiles on the floor. So they said, that's very nice, but all their neighbors don't have tiles. So he said, no, that's a wealthy city. Everyone has tiles on their floors. That's why it's permissible there. So today, in the state of Israel in 2018, we almost everyone, as far as we know, has tiles on their floor. That doesn't permit us to go and washing our floors on Shabbos, but that does permit us to deal with spills. Because we live in a place where most people have tiles on their floors, we're not dealing with dirt floors, so we have certain leniencies. The leniencies involve spills. They don't involve doing a full wash on Shabbos. The leniencies do not permit us to squeeze out a rag. And that's why Chazal do not want us pouring large amounts of water on the floor. So what happens if you drop a bottle of grape juice? Now you have grape juice in glass and you need to deal. So what are the prohibitions we're dealing with? We have to be careful with. Our prohibition is we're not supposed to squeeze out a rag. Our prohibition is I'm not supposed to flatten out the earth. Okay, I don't have earth on my floor. And another prohibition that many people don't know is I'm not allowed to take out a pkak. This is a Gemara. If I have in my house, we'll take our example today. You have those siphon, what's that called in English? You have the round thing in the floor?
The drain cover.
The drain hole, okay, the drain cover. So the drain cover, in ancient times, they also had holes that they used to fill. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara says you're not allowed to close that hole on Shabbos unless there's a designated handle. If it has a handle, if it's built with a handle, which most drains that I've seen do not, then I'm allowed to take it out because it was built for putting in and putting out, just like I'm allowed to open and close a window. It's built for opening and closing. I'm not building the wall by closing the window. I'm not building a mechitza by closing the trees because it's made for going up and down and opening and closing. Why am I allowed to close a door? Didn't I just build a mechitza? So no, because it's made for opening and closing. It has a hinge. It has a handle. It's made for that. But if my door handle comes out, I can't stick it in on Shabbos. I can't rebuild that handle. If my drain doesn't have a handle, I can't just take out the cover of the drain and put it back in on Shabbos. So unless I have a drain with a handle, which I haven't seen those, in theory, if it had a handle or you attached a handle to it, you'd be allowed to take it out on Shabbos and put it back. So those are the things I should pay attention to. I'm not allowed to flatten earth. I'm not allowed to squeeze out my rag. I'm not allowed to take out a pkak and put it back unless it has a handle. Now, so what am I doing with my grape juice? Okay, so I want to collect the broken glass, even though it's muktzeh. It's shivrei kelim, right? It's broken. It has no use on Shabbos. It just became muktzeh. But it's dangerous. So things that are dangerous, you're allowed to clean up. I was walking to the garbage bin out here after Sukkot, and I learned the Gemara. The Gemara says, if you see thorns out in the public domain on Shabbos, you're allowed to move them so people won't get harmed. So I always thought, today that's not relevant because we all wear shoes, who goes outside barefoot, what are the thorns going to do to us? I approached the garbage bin, there was a thorn bush on the floor, and the next thing I knew, the thorn went straight through my shoe and into my leg, and I discovered that we still have good thorns that pierce our shoes as well, and what the Gemara said is relevant today also. It's still dangerous to walk on thorns today. It went through a lot, I was very impressed. But at least I understood that the Gemara's example is relevant to us also. At any rate, having glass around the house, people today walk in their socks, people walk barefoot. We can't leave broken glass around the house, so even though technically it's muktzeh, practically we clean it up. We clean up the glass, we clean up the grape juice. Now I have a sticky floor. So I'm allowed to pour as much water as I need to clean up the sticky floor. I'm not allowed to do sponge of the whole house. I'm allowed to pour water wherever I need to clean it up. What I should not do is take a rag to dry up all that water, because there, Chazal, we're concerned. If you just dropped a whole bottle of grape juice, then you're going to need a lot of water to clean that up. That's the amount of water that you'll need about 4 or 5 rags to dry up. So there you have to drag the water away wherever you take your water to. You wouldn't be able to put a bunch of rags because there we're concerned you're going to squeeze them out. Technically, can you go to one area of the spill, wash it, dry it with a rag, and toss that rag into the bin? You could, and then you go to another place. So long as you're not reaching the point where you have rags that are very, very wet, there Chazal were concerned, being that that's the norm. That's what many people do every day. They bring their rags, they take them, they sew it. So Chazal didn't want us doing that on Shabbos. So that's I can clean a sticky floor. Now, counter. Counter's easier. What's my problem with the counter? If I have a sticky counter, I could just wipe it all, pour water, wipe it into the sink, and that's okay. What about a tablecloth? So, that's a very good question. I'll tell you 2 things, and you can take it home, discuss it with your husbands. When I learned it, so if you have a thick plastic tablecloth, like here, to my mind, there was no difference between our thick plastic and their leather. And to my mind, it should have been prohibited to clean, to if you have sticky things on your plastic tablecloth, I don't see why it wouldn't fall under the same category that Chazal said, don't pour water and start scrubbing on Shabbos. That was what I thought. And then I went to visit Rav Moshe Halberstam Zatzal from the Eidah Haredis. The story goes back about 15 years ago. And I asked him, Rabbi, if I have sticky things on my tablecloth, am I allowed to scrub them on Shabbos? And he said, yes. And I said, why? And he said, goodbye. I said, wait a second. What about leather? In the Shulchan Aruch it says leather is a problem. Why is this different than leather? He said, it's not leather. I said, it's mutter. Goodbye. And he kicked me out of his office. So I spent the next 10 years saying, I don't know why, but Rav Halberstam says it's mutter, so whoever wants to clean off a plastic tablecloth can. And then my wife showed me an article in Mishpacha by someone who learned by Rav Moshe Feinstein. And the person writes that Rav Moshe Feinstein told him, you can't scrub a plastic tablecloth, it's just like leather. So I said, oh. So he kicked me out of his office, but someone else said what I said, someone big. So I stopped scrubbing plastic tablecloths. And then, in preparation for your question here, I sent the question to one of the top students of Rav Vosner, and I asked, what's the custom in Israel? I didn't tell him everything I knew. I just asked, how do rabbis teach in Israel? In Israel, do they tell people they can scrub the plastic or not? And he said, they can, and that's what everyone does, and it's mutter. So whoever wants to do it is fine. So I'm saying again, you have Rav Moshe Halberstam from the Eda Charedus who says it's mutter. You have the top students of Rav Vosner who say it's mutter. And whatever, you don't have to ask me. We'll move on. Can I wash dishes in my sink on Shabbos, even if I likely won't use them again, but seeing them in my sink bothers me? I have company coming, and I don't want them sitting or seeing dirty in the sink. Okay, so where does this question come from? The question really begins with Suda Shlishit. You're eating Suda Shlishit, and you finish the meal on a summer, let's say you finish the meal at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, Matzei Shabbos is going to be 7:30. So are you allowed to take the food on the table and put it back in the fridge? Why are you putting it in the fridge? Not for Shabbos. You're doing it for Sunday. So isn't that a chana? You're preparing from Shabbos to Sunday. So the answer is no. It's not a chana because there's a normal way we run a house. When we eat a meal, when we end the meal, we put the food in the fridge. We don't say, I'm preparing for tomorrow by putting it in the fridge. We say, the way I deal with my milk is I use it, and when I'm done, I put it in the fridge. So acts that are inconsequential, acts that are not a major thing, they're part of the way I run the house, so or they're part of the way I deal, that's not called achana. I'm not preparing for a weekday. What about washing the dishes from Suda Shlishit? So ask any wife, and she'll tell you, I want my husband to do that. Wait, is it inconsequential or it's consequential? Well, that depends. If he does it, it's inconsequential. If I do it, it's very consequential, right? So washing dishes in most houses is it takes time. It's not something you just do. You end the meal, you have dishes. It's something that has to get done. It could be we do it many times a day, but at the end of the day, it's not something that we consider inconsequential. And that's why every posek I know of forbids washing dishes for weekday. I was at a certain big Rav's house who I was discussing this with. This was about 20 years ago. And I learned Chavrusa with his son. And I asked him the question. And he said, it's Aser. And then he and his wife left the table. And his son said to me, you're touching raw nerves. Don't do that. I said, what's the raw nerve? He said, this is a conversation since I can remember my parents. My father always says it's usher, and my mother always says I'm not listening. So, but bottom line, I asked this question to Rav Feinstein. I asked this question to a lot of people. Once upon a time, we lived in an apartment that was about the size of this room, and our kitchen and our living room were smaller than this living room. I mean, when you sat in the living room, the kitchen sinks were almost on your lap. It was very uncomfortable to sit there and see the dirty dishes. So I asked Rav David Feinstein, I said, are we allowed to clean the dishes? Because it's annoying. So he said, no. I said, you know, it's annoying to me. It's probably more annoying to my wife. So he said, you have a bath? I said, yeah. He said, put it in the bath. I said, okay. He said, you can't say just because something's annoying you that now it's a need to clean it on Shabbos. You're cleaning it for the weekday. It's annoying you because you see it, so put it somewhere you don't see it. That doesn't make it permissible to clean on Shabbos. So again, cleaning dishes on Shabbos, again, if it's dishes I'm using, I don't have to start asking myself, do I have 5 guests or 3 guests? I can clean all the dishes that I might come to use in the next meal. I don't have to ask myself, am I going to use this bowl for salad or not? If I think I might, I can clean it. I don't have to sit there and calculate the details. But then there are things that you know you're not using the next meal. You know for a fact. You know you're not using this pot, or pot we said is muktzah, after I finished using it. But there are many dishes that you know for a fact. Let's say you ate the second meal chulent, and you're eating the third meal dairy. So you know you're not using those dishes on Shabbos. You can't clean them on Shabbos. It's annoying. I told the story not to give an example of how we shouldn't listen, but rather that it's annoying to the point where even now his mother is the daughter of a very big rav. I'm saying this was a shidduch between two very, very big families. Okay, she's wrong. What can I do? I'm saying there's no. I don't know of any halachic authority that would permit washing the dishes because you're washing them. They're annoying you to see them. They annoy me to see them too. We should put them somewhere else. Like Rav Feinstein told me, I thought he was joking, but that's what he said. He said, put it in the bath. That doesn't allow you to wash them on Shabbos. Okay. The next question was, how can a woman make kiddush for herself Shabbos morning? What if I don't like the taste of grape juice? Can I even make a bracha on it if I would normally not drink it because I don't care for it? Okay, so this deserves a long introduction. The Rebbe of Chabad, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, initiated a program of sending out shlichim all over the world. And this was really a revolution. No one did it before him. People don't know that Rav Feinstein tried to do the exact same thing he did. And of all the students, only one succeeded. The Israeli. The one who didn't know the language. But he didn't know you could say no. So Rav Greenblatt, who had emigrated from Israel to learn by Rav Moshe Feinstein, was sent out to the Midwest, where there wasn't kosher food or a mikveh or anything else. And he had probably the hardest job, and he didn't have the language skills. But he didn't know you're allowed to say no. So all the other Talmidim came back and said, Rebbe, it's not working. And he stayed and built up, I think it was either Phoenix or Memphis, that he just built up the city. And Rav Moshe would travel out there and help them build the mikvah and did everything with him. So Rav Moshe tried it, but the Rebbe of Chabad built institutions and educated people to do it. And over the years, he sent out thousands and thousands of people to bring Yiddishkeit all over the globe. His mashal was, he said, in ancient times, as the night would come in, you had a person whose job it was to walk around the streets, and he would light the lanterns all over the streets, so there'd be light for people, right? Chazal say, that's what Dvorah's husband, Lapidot, that's what he used to do. He used to go and make sure people had light in the streets. And sometimes there were lamps that were very far. They weren't easily accessible. So the guy had to go and make sure, and sometimes other people had to go and make sure there was light. So he said, that was his mashal to his students, he said, we have to make sure there's light everywhere. There are a lot of places on the globe where there isn't light. And so he made this one of his major life missions, and he really changed a lot for the Jewish people. He asked that the shlichim would send him a picture. He asked one of his secretaries to arrange an album. He wants to see a picture of each of the shlichim. So they came back, and they brought him an album and a half filled with pictures of all the young rabbis who were all over the world doing their job. The Rebbe said, you didn't bring me what I asked for. So they said, no, we went through every person we have on record. They're all here. So he said, no, most of them are not here. So they asked him, what do you mean? So he said, you gave me only pictures of the men. What about their wives? What about their children? They're also shlichim. They're also out there working and bringing Yiddishkeit all over the globe. This isn't an album of all my shlichim. I want to see everyone. So they went back and got pictures of everyone. We have to know that the partnership that we have is a partnership. People sometimes think, if I'm married, so I have a full tank. If I'm not, I have half a tank. No, it's half a motor or a full motor. We work together in building a lot of things in our lives. And one of the things we're building is the Torah and the mitzvos we do. And for most people, we're really the only time that they can learn is on Shabbos. This happened to me numerous times that people told me that their only Torah is, one guy told me, it's your speech Shabbos morning. That's only Torah I learn all week. People don't have that much time, and people should try to find the time to learn, but the time on Shabbos, I know that our Shabbos morning class is not easy for a lot of the wives. I know that. Maybe we should also give out chocolate Shabbos morning, but people are fleishig. Before they get fleishig, right? It's not easy, but I'll tell you a secret. My family's also waiting, right? The reason we do it is because people...
It's going to be late.
Before we came here, I used to daven at 6. I used to be home from 8 taking care of the kids. I'd be learning and taking care of the kids. I'm saying we're doing it not because it's the schedule I like. I would never daven at an 8 o'clock minyan. We're doing it because we think it's what's right for the community. I'm saying there's a reality. And so the question stems from a positive place. We have to recognize it's not just the Rebbe who said there's a partnership. It's the Gemara that says it. The Gemara asks, Hani nashi b'may zachyan, what is the women's great merit? The Gemara says, because they wait. So I know husbands always joke that they're waiting for the wives. In our generation, many wives could tell you they're waiting for the husbands. It involves waiting. But that doesn't mean you can't make Kiddush. So I want to tackle this from many different angles because I assume it's relevant to a lot of people. The first thing you should know is that Kiddush by Shabbos day is just Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Borei Pri Hagafen. You don't have to say all the psukim. Now, if you have kids listening to your Kiddush, then you come to the question of, do you want to give them the Shabbos atmospheres? It's a good idea to say all the psukim. But then again, your husband might do it when he comes home. So if you're uncomfortable or if you're in a rush and you want to eat, you made a Baruch Pri Hagafen, you drank the cup of wine for Shabbos day, that's kosher Kiddush. Do you have to make it on grape juice? Well, ideally you should make it on grape juice. Do you have to make Kiddush altogether? Can you eat and drink without Kiddush? So that depends on many factors. We're going to go with Rav Moshe Feinstein here. We're going to rely on him, even though in Israel he's probably not so well known in this matter. Rav Moshe says that until your husband finishes davening, you don't have an obligation of Kiddush. Because he quotes from the Halacha and Evin Ezer. In the laws of marriage, it says one of the things that couples can expect from one another is to eat together. So even if during the week you don't have time to eat together, everyone expects that on Shabbos you're going to eat together. So Rav Moshe says it's not like you have an option to sit down for a meal before your husband comes home. It's part of the marriage that you're not going to do that. But then he says something interesting, which is where our shir runs into trouble. He says that's only if he's davening. You know, he's doing the regular things. If he's going to stay and learn another hour, so then technically you can't say, well, I'm waiting for him. The time that he was obligated to invest is done. He's going to take a choice and wait outside for another hour, shooting the breeze or whatever. You can't say for that hour, I don't have a chiyuv of Kiddush. He makes that distinction. So whatever time you think your husband finished his davening, in our shul about 10:05, at that point you're chayiv in Kiddush. Before that, you're not chayiv. So if you want to eat and drink and do what you want until 10:05, if he's davening by us, so then you have no problem. You don't need Kiddush. Okay, I don't like grape juice. I don't either like grape juice, right? The question, I don't either like grape juice. But so long as it's not really bad, if a person says, I hate the flavor, if it's just I don't like it, I also don't like it. Bottom line, it has a flavor, it's edible, it deserves a bracha. So we make a bracha on grape juice. If a person says, you know, it makes me want to throw up, and then you run into a problem. But if it's just, I really don't like grape juice, well, I don't either like grape juice. And we still make our Kiddush on grape juice. How much do you have to drink? So you have to drink the majority of a Malo Lugmav. So how much would that be? Can I have a cup? Thank you. So that from the top of the cup till here. It's not a lot. I'm saying that's how much you have to drink. Okay? It's not a lot. I'm saying you don't really have to drink a lot. It's a little bit more than a kazayas. Okay? Not Rov Kos. Well, your husband has to drink Rov Kos. Well, he doesn't either. But lechatchila, it's nice to drink Rov Kos. Again, they were talking about a kos that has a revius. So if a revius, we're going to say, is up to here, right? So it's 51% of that. If I'm going from the bottom to the top. So Shabbos Day Kiddush is drabanan. A revius is an egg and a half. If I'm going to go, so our eggs, the volume of our eggs, right, is about, you guys know this better than me, the volume of our eggs is about this much, so if I'm going to flatten that out, that's here. plus another half an egg, that brings me up to here. Okay? Now, you'll ask me, how come I'm estimating? Because everyone estimated. No one walked around measuring things. In Chazal's time, it was an estimation, right? Chazal assumed we would estimate what a Revius is, what a Kazayas is. No one expected us to sit and measure things out. Chazal said, what you think is, that's the way the halacha works. So our Revius is about this much. So our Rov Revius is a little bit more than this. That's for your husband. Okay? There is a concept of Rov Kos. And if a person doesn't like grape juice, they should do what I do. I get a cup that's exactly a Revius. So my Rov Kos is my Rov Revius. Okay.
Can I ask a question on that?
Sure.
I thought that Kiddush only applied for things that were mizonos. Mm-hmm. So like having tea before that was fine. That's not the case.
Once we're having Kiddush, we really shouldn't eat or drink until we make Kiddush by day. Also by night. However, there is the opinion of Rav Moshe's Talmidim. And this is also not necessarily everyone agrees to this, and that is that if I don't like grape juice, so then I can make on Shabbos day my Kiddush on what's called Chamar Medina. The Gemara brings a story of a rabbi who visited a town. There was no wine there, so he made his Avdallah on beer. So they asked him, how are you making it on beer? You're supposed to make Avdallah on wine. So he said, that's Chamar Medina. That's the local honorable beverage. The local honorable beverage. So what's our local honorable beverage? Coca-Cola. So the question is, no, it's a real question. What's called an honorable beverage? So the halacha says water is not an honorable beverage. So people say, but today you could pay a lot of money for mineral water, right? That's the, if you go to a pish-posh place, they bring you mineral water. Okay, water is not an honorable beverage, even though today we treat it that way. What about soda water? No. What about milk? No. It says in halacha, that's not an honorable beverage. So wait a second. So what is Coca-Cola? It's fizz water. You know, they call it mayim shchorim koftzim, right? Black, jumpy water. What's Coca-Cola, right? So that's a big discussion in halacha. Rav Moshe doesn't like the idea of using soda for chamar medina. But I think in Eretz Yisrael, even in America, Rav Moshe didn't really say not to. He didn't like it. And in Israel, where we treat Coca-Cola on a much higher level. And then you run into the question of coffee. Is that an honorable beverage? If a person is really has a problem drinking grape juice, so they can rely on those opinions. Make their shahakal on a cup of coffee. Remember, you don't have to say all the psukim. And then they've covered themselves with chamar medina. The real question I wanted to get to, we're out of time for. Cooking par food in a meat dairy oven. Par of cake in a meat oven. Meaning, either one. I have my oven, I use it for meat, I want to make a par of cake. Can I eat it with coffee? I make a par of burekas in my dairy oven. Can I now serve it at a meat meal? Okay, so... I'm scared we won't get to cover that correctly, and I even wrote an outline for everyone. So we'll try to reconvene in a month, saying it's not fair. It's too serious to discuss when I don't know that I'll cover it correctly. I sense everyone disagrees. Okay? It's an important question.
But there's probably more important questions also.
Right, it's there were a lot of good questions and interesting questions. Really good questions. We're not going to get to all the questions. I could answer more shortly, but I think everyone wants to understand. To just get a yes or no, I don't think you walk away with a lot. I could have answered all the questions in 20 minutes, but I don't think that's a good idea. If you disagree, you could tell Mrs. Mandel and tell me, and then next time it'll be much shorter. Yes, no, yes, no. But I don't think you get much out of it. So the question is, which question? I'd like to deal with the question from. Okay, I'm going to quickly deal with two questions. One question was asked, Tu Bishvat, why is it now? Is it connected to Hanukkah, the last festival, or Purim, the next festival? So I brought a book which I want people to know. This is called The Book of Our Heritage. It's a wonderful book. When I started teaching at age 13, I used this. Like all my classes came from this. It exists in Hebrew, in English, pocket size, big size, Rav Eliyahu Kitov, as mothers. It's beautiful because it covers the basic halachot, it covers the stories, the midrashim. I highly recommend you get this book and read it. And you'll know what every holiday is all about. You'll know everything you need to know and more. You could be a perfect teacher for Judaism just based on this book. It's a bemit. If you want to know what every holiday and what every month is about, that's a great book. In a nutshell, Tu Bishvat is the time that the majority of the rains were supposed to have finished. The Gemara discusses the sap in the trees. And the Gemara says that the fruits get their sweetness from the sap that's moving in the trees. And the Gemara says, our assumption is that the sap is moving within the tree already, and the fruits are reaching what's called chanata, which we'll just translate as a third of its ripening. And the majority of what has to happen as far as the rain and moving the sap into the fruit is already in motion. And so our assumption is that everything that's going to happen from Tu Bishvat onward is a product of last year's rain. Meaning the movement of the sap and the sweetness of the fruits and everything that's going to happen, we're assuming is happening, that Tu Bishvat is the cutoff point from the effects of last year's rains affecting the fruits now, and from this point onward, we don't believe the rain is going to have a major impact on our fruit, on this year's fruit. That's a short explanation of Tu Bishvat, and that's why Tu Bishvat is the cutoff point, because we look at the rain season and the sap's movement in the trees, something which is not really visible to the naked eye, and we say from Tu Bishvat onward, all fruits that are going to start blossoming and growing and reaching a third of their ripeness will be considered next year's fruits. Our year, with regard to Trumot Masrot, with regard to trees, starts at Tu Bishvat. So up until Tu Bishvat, we're dealing with this year. Tu Bishvat's going to come, next year begins, and we assume whatever rains and whatever happens after Tu Bishvat and whatever fruits start growing will benefit from next year's rains already. That's in a nutshell. But again, if you want to understand more about Tu Bishvat, I recommend looking here. Another question that was asked, which also we'll deal with quickly. I'm home with my baby, and I usually can't find to daven a proper Shmoneh Esrei. Sometimes I try when the baby is sleeping, but when I think about it, it is often after Shachris time and before Mincha time. Do Zmanim apply to women? Can I daven Shmoneh Esrei whenever I am able to find time? So, the first thing you have to know is that you don't have to daven Shmoneh Esrei. You don't have to, and women never did. This is recorded already in the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Magen Avram. Many of you might have learned in seminary that the Mishnah Brura writes, you should daven Shmoneh Esrei, at least Shachris and Mincha, and when possible, Ma'ariv. That's true. But as far as we know, his wife didn't. Why? Because a woman, by the very nature of being a wife and a mother, is almost always busy with mitzvot, meaning running a house is your mitzvah. You're not just doing idle things. You know, if you're on WhatsApp, go daven. If you're on Facebook, go daven. Yeah, you're 100% right. But most people are not spending an hour or two a day, I hope, on WhatsApp or Facebook. If you are, you should daven three times a day. Might have to. But what might happen, it might be very bad advice what I'm saying, is that people will daven three tefillot a day and still spend 2 hours on WhatsApp, and the kids won't get breakfast, lunch, or supper. So I'm not sure that's the right advice. So we're way out of time. We're going to pick up here with understanding the balance of zmanim for women, what women should be davening, when women should be davening, how women should be davening. We'll have to pick up here, Bezat Hashem. Next time, we'll have to see what we could coordinate. I don't know what time. Another question that people asked, which was a great question, and it's very important, as far as kashruyot, why is it that people are uncomfortable with the Rabbanut? What's the problem? Why not just say it's Orthodox, it's kosher, why not? Is there any benefit to maybe taking other kashriyot or not? So we'll discuss that, and we'll also discuss the questions of ovens and meat and dairy and pots and parv. Very, very good questions which are practical, and also an outline, which I guess I'll give up as Hashem next time, that you can hang on your fridge to know if you cook potatoes in a meat pot, can you serve them with sour cream or not? When yes, when no. We'll cover that Bezat Hashem next time. And if people have more questions, so feel free to email either me or Ms. Mandel, my wife. Yeah.
Can you only ask one question, maybe a little bit quicker? When I have a challah baked in a baserie oven, can I use it for Seder Shishit for challah?
It's a quick question, but a long answer.
But in general. I say no. But
Angels has good prayer stuff.
Let's do the question justice, because we have to discuss, is the pan clean or dirty? Is the oven clean or dirty?
Okay,
has it been used in 24 hours? Do I turn it on? Right. Do I heat up the oven before I put things in?
Okay,
saying there are too many details that even if I can say it quickly,
okay,
it's not really, no one's going to understand it. So let's, I think the format we used, people can really, I hope, we didn't go too quickly. If people have feedback, I'll be happy to hear it. To say less details, more details, quicker, slower, let me know. And be in touch with Ms. Mendel. B'ezrat Hashem, we'll coordinate the next time. Yisher koach, and again, thank you very, very much. Yisher koach.